Okay, we will convene the meeting here at 8:31 this morning. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Our first order of business on our agenda is the moment of silence for those retired police and fire officers who passed during late November and December. Let's take a moment of silence. Okay, thank you. Next is our approval of the minutes from our December 10th meeting. Anybody have any comments, changes, or corrections? Hearing none, can I get a motion to approve?
So moved.
I'll make the motion.
Alan, second.
Okay, Alan was second, and who was first?
Nick, I said motion. I think somebody else said it at the same time.
Okay. Nick and Alan, okay, that's great. Okay, next we go on to the detailed consent agenda, as I normally do. Kelly, is there anything unusual in here that we need to focus on?
The only thing I wanted to point out is you'll see on this consent agenda there are two members joining drop. And right now, with the way that the plan works, members will typically only join drop once they hit their 90%. What you should see in 2021 is a pretty big increase in members joining drop because there's a spike. There's kind of a lump that's going through the system where a lot of members will hit their 90% in 2021 and 2022. So we expect to see, you should expect to see on a monthly basis more people joining drop or possibly more retirements because of that kind of lump of employees that were all hired at the same time. But that's all I wanted to point out. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. Any questions before we ask for a motion to approve? Okay, can we get a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Yeah, this is Ken. So moved.
Okay. I've heard a motion and a second. Got that, Kelly? Or all in favor? Aye. Say favor.
Aye.
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 Anybody opposed? Okay. John, do you want to get, what is it star five, if anybody in the public wants to address the trustees at this point?
Yes, star five. They'll press that on their phone, and I'll unmute them so they can speak. I'm not seeing any.
Okay, thank you. We'll continue to move forward then. Next item is my report, basically, or discussion item. One thing I wanted to mention to the trustees is that back in September when I was contemplating leaving the board, I had a discussion with the mayor, and one of the things I told him was that I really thought we needed to focus on getting the plan better funded and not waiting until 2024. Subsequently, in December, he generally agreed with me and asked that both myself and Rob Walters try to come up with an independent group of people who could study the issue. Rob and I had done a little bit of work identifying different kinds of firms, some endowments, some accounting firms, some legal firms, some banks who have worked with public funds and have a whole bunch of different solutions they would propose. We've also put together a small group of about four financially competent people, one attorney with some public finance experience, and they are going to, you know, interview all these outside sources, look at these items, and go ahead and make recommendations, hopefully by mid-year, to the mayor, who then would look at them with the city manager and then to the city council I think the mayor's view is let's not have a crisis in 2024. Let's try to address this sooner than later. And this is the first step in doing that. So I just wanted to let people know that that is taking place. I think it's a very positive step. It's going to be an independent group, basically. There wouldn't be a representative from ours on there. There'll be independent people. So I just wanted to mention that. I got a note here from, this is a John. You say somebody does want to speak?
Yeah, we got a hand raised.
Well, you got one person or?
Just one.
Okay. I'm done with my report, so why don't we let that person speak, and then we will come back and continue with the legislative preview.
Okay, they're unmuted now.
Yes, whoever's on the line, can you identify yourself and give us your comments?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name is David Elliston, and I'm the president of the Dallas Police Retired Officers Association. Retired from DPD in 2010 as a deputy chief, and served the citizens of Dallas for well over 38 years with the department. And my comment today is regarding the staff's proposal for a defined benefit plan. I listened to the discussion last month, and I have since visited with our DPROA executive board as well as some leaders of other retiree associations. The one consistent stipulation that I heard from all was that the staff's defined benefit plan should not provide benefits that are not afforded to our members. Now, from what I heard Armando reporting last month in the meeting was that he had received some of the same comments from some of the actives. I know that Kelly argued that TMRS was in no way a better plan than ours. And if that's true, then there should not be any opposition from the staff to transition into the Dallas Police and Fire Pension Plan. That would put us all on an even playing field with everyone paying in the same amounts and reaping the same benefits. I think the members, active and retired, would embrace such a move as it will result in having more people paying into the fund. I can't tell you why the earlier attempts to move them into our plan failed, but it really doesn't matter since members no longer vote on plan changes. Kelly says that the move to move them into the TMRS would take legislative action, but so would moving them into our plan. So that's really a moot issue. I think that now we should take this opportunity to demonstrate to state legislators, city council members, and the citizens alike that we're all in the same boat and paddling in the same direction as we try to recapitalize our pension plan. Now, I also heard last month that HILCO had already been consulted regarding legislative approval to make the move to TMRS. So my question there is it really appropriate to spend Dallas Police and Fire pension funds to lobby for a defined benefits plan that does not serve Dallas Police and Fire pension members? And that is my comment, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, David. We're going to cover the retirement plan one more item down the agenda after HILCO speaks. I mean, my only comment was I think it is a benefit to have a plan that can attract staff and retain staff so that we have competent people to continue to be able to provide the services that we are now, both the investment and the administrative services. So, I mean, I think that's sort of my personal view, but we will discuss this in more detail in about probably in about another 20 minutes or so. So listen in on that. Thank you for your comment.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, this is Armando. I have a question. Will the members be allowed to speak during that item as it comes up, or should they do it now? Because I know that there's some people that are having trouble with the new Zoom link and phone line trying to get through.
I think there are two up. I mean, there's the opportunity to speak now, and then there's an opportunity. I'm looking at the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we have another section towards the end of the meeting here?
We don't have it listed, but Bill, you can open it up anytime you want to do that.
Okay. Okay, we will probably do that towards the end of the meeting, then. We'll give them an opportunity to speak before we do anything. As we get through that discussion, we'll see where we are on that discussion and if that makes some sense, Armando.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Rob French. Real quick. I just wanted to, one, kind of go back real quick to the announcement you made. That's fantastic news, and thank you for letting everybody know about that. Is there a plan for them once they've kind of the task force has been solidified and they've gone into their due diligence period of asking various trusts and banks on what their opinions are and their options are on raising money for the fund. Is there at some point, are they going to come back to the board or would they come to the board and basically kind of present, hey, guys, you know, here's what we've found. You know, here's some of the things that we're going to talk to the mayor about and almost, you know, get our opinion as well in that process.
I think the mayor has asked us to have this group give him a report that he could study with the city, and then he would then evaluate that and share it with the city council if it made sense, and I mean, depending on what the recommendations were. There's not something built in, but that's probably the point that it would make more sense is after the mayor has moved forward is to, you know, keep the trustees informed as to where it is. And I think I think the recommendations are going to be pretty simple. How do you get X dollars into the plan, whether that's a billion or whatever?
You said retirees.
And do you do it through a POB? Do you do it through a sale of assets? Do you do something else? But that would be the point. After the mayor says he's willing to move forward.
He asked me about anything he's going to say.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for that. And then also, I just want to let you know, Mr. Chairman, I'm on the meeting today, but I'm on active duty Air Force orders right now. So if I have to step away briefly, that's why I'm not here. So
thank you.
I'd like to make one comment on this committee. I understand the effort to make it really independent of the city or pensions, but does it make sense not to have someone on that committee that has some experience on pensions because pensions are so unique and how they present their financial liabilities are not so transparent sometimes?
We do have a former trustee of the Texas Teachers Retirement System on that committee, so the answer is yes, and there is somebody with that background.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure.
Yep. Okay, anybody else before we move on to the legislative preview? Okay, Kelly, is the Hilco folks there?
They are, and before we get started, I'd like to just remind everybody to be on mute if they're not speaking. That will hopefully help with the background noise. And just by way of introduction for the new trustees and a reminder for the ones that have been around for a while, Hilco has been the legislative consultants for DPFP for many years, I think going back to the early 1990s. At one point, we did have two different firms that we used, but beginning in 2018, we went exclusively with Hilco. Hilco did a great job for us in 2017, passing HB 3158, which was no easy task for sure. On the phone is Buddy Jones, Clint Smith, and Eddie Solis, and they're here today to give you a preview of what will be probably a very unique legislative session this year. Their presentation starts on page 19. So with that, gentlemen, you can take it over. And just let John Holt know if you need us to change the pages for you.
Okay. Thank you, Kelly. This is Clint Smith talking, and as she said, we have Buddy Jones, who's our founding partner here at Hilco, and Eddie Solis. All three of us have worked a long time with Dallas Police and Fire, and it's been a real privilege for our firm to be able to represent y'all. Before we get started on the presentation, I want to make one clarification that the gentleman in the comments made. We have been consulted by Kelly and Josh and told what they were looking into, but we have not made in any way any type of any contacts, done any movement or anything. We're waiting instructions, whatever the board should find at their pleasure. So that's kind of where it stands as far as Hilco. There has been no lobbying on that, but I did want to clarify that at the start. As Kelly said, this is going to be a very unique legislative session. All three of us have been around the legislative process a long time, and we have never been under these circumstances. There's a lot of new rules, a lot of new things that are going to happen, and we're going to try to explain to you what we're going to be dealing with as far as the legislature, as well as you, if you need to deal with your legislative representatives. To start it off with, and we'll turn to the first page there, we kind of want to give you an idea of the legislative landscape, and Buddy is going to cover that. And by the way, anywhere along here, if somebody has questions, be sure and just stop us, and we'll try to deal with them.
Thanks, Clint. This is Buddy Jones and Mr. Chairman and the honorable staff. We are, I'm going to echo what Clint said. It has been our great pleasure and a real blessing to have been a part of this family for a long time. And we appreciate the faith and confidence you have placed in us. And we are committed to helping this entity going forward into the future. So thank you for all that. Kelly, I think your comment that this is going to be a unique session is way understated. Some of us probably remember the old show, The Twilight Zone, and there are days I wake up thinking Rod Serling is going to walk right through the front door and say, welcome to the Twilight Zone, because I think that's where we are in terms of the 87th legislative session. We're not 100% positive, but I think we're going to all be tested before we walk into the building. I think they're going to control how many people are in the building. I think that testimony during committee hearings is going to be extremely limited. That really makes for a challenging session. Any legislation that has, I'll say, flies on it, or there's two different sides and people are fighting, it's going to be a real hard session to pass a bill if there's a lot of opposition to it. So I think we need to keep that in mind as we go forward. Here's what I think will be done in the regular session of the legislature. And notice I said regular session. I anticipate there will be one or more special sessions, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But the regular session, I think, is going to be dominated by three issues. One is a broad issue, anything COVID-related. And, Mr. Chairman, that includes rural broadband, distance learning, everything that has kind of resulted and has been shown as lacking because of the COVID situation. I think those bills will be the first bills taken up and will be the bills that are the most talked about. There will be some who want to curb the governor's powers during a pandemic situation. There will be those who want to strengthen the governor's powers during a pandemic situation. And so all things COVID is number one. The second will be the one bill we have to pass, and that's an appropriations bill. I've got to say that we thought about it when the pandemic began. Most of us thought we were going to have possibly a $20 billion shortfall for the biennium, and that has not played out. Texas has weathered some of the storm in a lot better shape than other states, and we don't have that problem, but we do have a shortfall. And so the appropriations and budget may be the only committee that meets in the first 60 days, finance in the Senate, appropriations in the House. We don't know. And then the third major issue, which I think we'll see a little bit of during the regular session, is redistricting. And the reason I say a little bit of, there will be hearings. It will be on the forefront of every legislator's mind. But I'm not sure we're going to have all of the documents and the data to actually pass a congressional or a House or Senate redistricting during the regular session. And that creates some interesting challenges in terms of special sessions and the Legislative Redistricting Board involvement in redistricting. So those are the three areas I think we need to watch. Of course, there will be other bills that are filed. We are up to 1,099 House bills, which is a whole lot lower than we usually have at this time. And I think we're at like 500 Senate bills, 400 Senate bills, and that's a whole lot less than what we've had in the past. So I anticipate there will be fewer bills passed and certainly fewer bills that have significant opposition to them. Real quickly, the Texas House has a brand new speaker as of day before yesterday. His name is Dade Phelan from Beaumont. He was chairman of the House State Affairs Committee last session. He is a fairway Republican. He plays the ball exactly where it lies, and I think he'll be a fair, good, just administrator of the House. And I believe the membership of the House is generally very, very pleased. I think he only had two votes against him, which is kind of shows that he's got broad-based support. And we don't know about House committees yet. I don't believe they're going to come out till the end of January or the 1st of February. So we don't know who's going to be on the pension committee. And we don't know who's going to be the chairman of it. And I think we'll have a new chairman, tell you the truth. The current chairman was very active in the new speaker's race, and I anticipate he'll maybe move up to a committee that has broader jurisdiction than just pensions. And I'm guessing, but he's been a great chairman of pensions, as was the previous one. But I think we'll see a new chairman, so we need to be on standby as we figure out who's going to be on committees. Senate, there's really not a much of a transition. We've the same lieutenant governor. The Senate last session had 19 Republicans. There was one less Republican elected this time, and it went to 18 Republicans and 13 Democrats. Lo and behold, last night about 7 o'clock, the Senate changed its rules to, it used to be 19 votes to bring a bill up for consideration on the floor of the Senate. Guess what happened last night? Since there's 18 Republicans, the new number is 18. So it takes 18 to suspend to bring a bill up for a vote on the floor of the Senate. There was some, I don't really think it was heated debate. This was, there are not that many bills that are all Democrat versus Republican or Republican versus Democrat. But there was a good deal of debate on lowering that threshold from 19 to 18. But it passed by a vote of, you guessed it, 18 to 13. There is one new committee that the Senate's going to create called the Committee on Jurisprudence, and it's going to deal with judicial redistricting. The lieutenant governor told me recently that he felt like this would be a session where we would set a record for the fewest bills passed in the history of the Texas legislature since they've been keeping records of that. There's only going to be a very few days that the Senate is on the floor. They're only meeting 2 days a week in committees, and used to they'd be 5 days a week, and sometimes on the weekend, 2 days a week in the Senate. We're not sure about the House yet. They've still got some work to do to decide, but that shows you the slowdown in the legislative process. And so, Kelly, unique is probably, like I said, an understatement. It's certainly going to be a very different session from business as usual. And I can't leave my remarks without telling you all how much I appreciate our first responders. I'm a former district attorney from 66th Judicial District over in Hillsboro. And from an early time out of my law school, I came to appreciate the fire departments and the police and the sheriffs in my area. And thank you for what you do for all of us in Texas. Clint?
We'll change the slide here and do the next one. There we go. Buddy has covered some of the impact that COVID's had on the legislative session, but it's really it's a lot bigger than that. We're going to see something so different than we've ever seen before. As we've got here on the slide, the flow of legislation will likely be limited or hindered by the protocols they set up. In the Senate, we basically know how they're going to operate. And as Buddy said, there's going to be starting off 2 days. Right now, after the House adopts their rules today, the House and Senate are adjourning until January 26th. And then we hear they'll come back a couple of days a week, and that's probably all. So there'll be very limited legislation. The important thing that happened in the Senate yesterday was changing the threshold to bring up legislation from 19 votes to 18. The Democrats had wanted it to be just a simple majority, but it's not that way, and it passed by a pure party vote on that. We do know that in the Senate that they will never have, they're saying, more than two committees meeting at a time, which some days we used to have five, six, seven, and that right there limits bills that will be considered. Over on the House side, one of the things, and this is also in the Senate, in any committee hearings, masks are going to be required. They're going to be required on the House and Senate floor. And the Senate yesterday passed a rule saying that you can't even be in the gallery without a mask. So masks are going to be required just about anywhere. The only exception to the mask rule that has been made, the House will adopt a rule today that says when you are speaking to testifying to a House committee, that you can lower your mask to talk into the microphone, and members can lower their mask to ask you questions. Otherwise, it's full mask all the time. One of the rules that will be changed today in the House is that committee meetings can be televised, and that will be sufficient to satisfy the constitutional rule that they have to be open to the public. They're going to allow you to, instead of testifying, submit electronically your testimony, and it will be incorporated into the record of the committee hearing. Another interesting rule that we expect to be passed today in the House is that the committee chairman is urged to limit the amount of witnesses on any committee, but he or she is also encouraged to have people from both sides. Now, how that's going to work, I don't know, and who's the referee on whether you've got the right people from both sides. It will be interesting to see how that works out. There's another controversial rule that will be considered today in the House, and that is they're going to come up with a new class of bills for floor debate. And there's a lot of controversy around it, and it'll be interesting to hear the debate on it. But basically, the calendars committee, which sends every bill that's not a local and consent bill to the floor, will designate certain bills that are non-controversial to go to the floor, and they will, it will be called a consensus calendar. And the rules on that calendar will be that only people can only speak against the bill for 3 minutes or for the bill for 3 minutes. And it's supposed to be an expedited system. Now, where the conflict is coming on this, that a lot of members think that should a calendar committee, which is typically made up of 11, 13 people, have the right to say what is a consensus. And so it'll be interesting to see how that particular aspect plays out.
Clint, I'm going to interrupt you right here. Last night, there was a huge meeting in the Speaker's office about that particular calendar. You're right. It has engendered a lot of interest. And if Alan Vaught's on the call, he would have been right in the middle of this talking about whether it's good, bad, or and how it could be changed. But I believe there's a
I'd probably be asking you what you thought about it, actually. But
and I'll probably demur, Alan. So long and short, I think they're going to withdraw that. That's a guess on my part, but I think the discussion, Alan, was so intense that the leadership decided maybe we don't need to pursue this third calendar. But we'll see. The jury's still out, but I kind of think it's a hung jury and they're not going to go forward with it.
Moving on, I want to talk some about access to the Capitol. This is another interesting thing. They've got the only place you're going to be able to get in the Capitol is the north entrance. They've set a tent up there where they're going to do COVID testing. So far, you don't have to take a COVID test to go in the Capitol. And there's rumor that they are going to change that, and you will have to take a COVID test to get in the Capitol. We at Hillco have tested it. You have to, what you have to do is you have to set up a profile, and then each time you go to the Capitol, you tell them who you are, and if you submit to a test, it's one of the rapid tests, and you perform it under supervision. And you have to usually wait about 15 minutes to get your results, and then you go in. We don't know what's for sure what's going to happen right now. Completely up to you whether or not you get tested, so we'll see what happens on that. One of the other thing, now legislators and legislative staff, they will be tested regularly. And they're different. The House and Senate have different protocols on that. As y'all know, it's been a tradition that they've recognized people from the floor that have had different accomplishments, like sports teams, things like that. None of that will happen this session. There will be no city days. Cities come down, and it might be like Abilene Day or Corpus Christi Day or Dallas Day. And they have receptions and stuff for the legislators. There'll be no teachers, realtors, nurses. All them had special days, and they were there at the Capitol. None of that will happen. There'll be no tours, and none of the school children will be allowed to come in like they do every year and tour the Capitol. So it's going to be pretty well shut down and pretty limited. All the committee rooms have been fitted with the plexiglass borders so that people are basically separated. There will be limited access to committee rooms. And we hear in the big auditorium that's in the annex that witnesses that are to appear will have to sit there in that with social distancing in that auditorium until they're called by the committee. We haven't got a confirmation on that yet, but that is supposed to be what's going to happen. I'm going to stop here, and before I turn it over to Eddie, he's going to talk actually some of the landscape for retirement plans. But does anybody have any questions or anything they want to ask of us? Okay, hearing none, we'll change the slide and let Eddie Solis talk about the landscape for the local retirement plans.
Thanks, Clint. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members, or trustees. Thank you for having us here. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning, and to echo Clint and Buddy, it's a privilege to serve you all, and thank you for the work you do for the system, the members, the retirees, and their families. It's an important task, and you all take it seriously, and we're thrilled and privileged to play what little role we do. But thank you for all the work. It's been a rough go for public pensions since I've been in the pension world in the mid-2000s. I think there's a better understanding, a different level of what I will refer to as sophistication at the Capitol. Before, you wouldn't get members talking much about amortization or rates of return or those types of questions, but they do this these days, and I think it's a good thing because they need to realize the work that you all do. With that being said, the PRB has grown in its importance, I think. Clint's been working in this environment for quite a while. I think the PRB has also grown in its capabilities, in its trustworthiness, and as we see what they have produced over the last several sessions, as a responsibility to the legislature, their recommendations, and I'll give them this benefit of the doubt, are intended to implement belts and suspenders, if you will, to reports that are already required or to proposals that have been introduced and passed, as a couple of bills were last session on investment reports and funding policies. And I appreciate Kelly and Josh always being at the ready to help me and us understand these provisions deeper than we do, because they certainly have quite a bit of a lot more experience and knowledge than I do, for sure. So I feel that the legislature, given its role, its responsibility financially to the employees' retirement system and the teachers' retirement system, is where they'll spend most of their attention this session. Not only typically is that their main importance, but given the budgetary issues and the time restraints or bandwidth, I think that'll be a lot more visible to cover those costs, make sure teachers and employees are doing well. And so that in and of itself is a pretty big task. The Pension Review Board, as I mentioned, had produced their recommendations to the legislature. And we've seen, and I speak here of them in general, and we can dive a little deeper into them as you all would like. But they're surrounding the funding soundness restoration plans, the sponsoring entity, its involvement in the operations of the system, and I'll go back to that here shortly, and then furthering the transparency of investments with their investment report, and who should be doing that report, as that has been a discussion since that bill that passed last session, as we've been talking to Chairman Huffman when she introduced this bill two sessions ago in the 85th. But I'll go back to, real quick, the sponsoring entity involvement. What I have seen, and Josh and Kelly, Clint, Buddy, please correct me or confirm here, what I have seen is that the Pension Review Board has taken a better focus on the role of the sponsoring entity to the health of a retirement system. For so long, I think many members, many of the public, and agencies would look to the system and say, you're not in good condition, you need to fix this. And our response would always be, we can only do so much on the backs of our members and with the plan, but the sponsoring entity needs to live up to their responsibility of a sound contribution rate. And it's a pretty basic concept, but if you take a look at the systems and even what the PRB has published in the past, there is an obvious link to the health and condition of a retirement system related to the responsibility of the sponsoring entity's commitment to contributions. So I think that's a good development. Where it goes, we have to guide or keep an eye on. But I do feel that that's a good development in the evolution of the sophistication that I was referring to of members understanding these systems better. The one area that I think is also in that section of this presentation, I want to maybe stop and see if anyone might have some questions.
Hey Eddie, this is Ken Haven.
Yes,
I've got one question on the PRB. First of all, I want to thank Hilco for being here today. I wish I could say good seeing you all again, but I'll just say good hearing you all again. And thanks for all your hard work you've done for us. My question is on the PRB, the new member, Mr. Robert Reese, I guess is his name.
Yes,
any concerns, pro or con, of him?
Kind of still feeling it out. I wish I could answer that better, but he's a state employee, so that lends itself to something, that's the short answer. The longer answer, of course, is, you know, sometimes we certainly focus on who's coming in, what kind of threat that they might be, whatever the case, because that's in my world, I worry first and I relax later. But I'm pleased by the level of connection, communication, and attention that Chair Leiby and Vice Chair Brainerd allow us. And now Zook as chairman of the Subcommittee on Investments. But as we find out more about that, we'll certainly share that with Kelly and Josh to communicate. But at this point, it's kind of neutral, not too worrisome. We'll all remember when Josh McGee got appointed many, many sessions back. And in my opinion, it just continued as almost as business as usual. But at any rate, I appreciate the question. I wish I had more of an answer, but I'm not overly worried at this point. But as things develop, we'll certainly communicate.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Yes, sir. If there aren't any other questions there, I'll just mention briefly on this slide the municipal funding issues. As many of you all probably know, the state doesn't send hardly any money to municipalities. However, there are issues that have been discussed that would affect the ability for municipalities to raise revenue. One example that I have here is a very, very, hot political topic of defunding police. And without wanting to get into the specifics of what city's doing what, the reason that I wanted to mention that was because we will see proposals that will be positioned or intending to be punitive to a municipality that goes in that direction. And so that, if it were to be successful, could limit a city's ability to raise more revenue when it needs it, especially in these particular difficult times. That's one example. But the area that is most focused of funding for municipalities from the state is hardly ever focused on what they're sending them, so much as what they're doing to them to keep them from raising more money in an appropriate fashion. But at any rate, I just wanted to lay that out. If we could go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So going back to interim reports issues, the House Pensions and Investments and Financial Services Committee, as Buddy mentioned, I suspect we'll see a change in leadership and committee makeup, which is not a criticism on current makeup, but just a reality of a different leadership in the House. Chairman Murphy has been very accessible to us, and we've enjoyed and benefited from working with his committee and office staff. Over the interim, they looked at the two bills that were passed last session, and from that, and very limited input because of COVID, have come up with recommendations. They're here. I think the most, the one that catches the most attention will be what I feel, and we've talked about for many sessions, of really changing the dynamic of the agency, where they feel that they should have a slightly different ability on the enforcement of pensions that are not doing well. Although that sounds like a noble effort, that's really a huge, huge shift, taking an oversight agency to becoming essentially a regulatory or enforcement agency. And there's a lot that goes into that. We'll be watching that in talking with his staff and the committee. I do not get the indication that anybody's filing or, proposing these bills or looking to propose these bills at this time. But this particular report's only been out a couple of weeks, so we shall see. And that's what we do here. We keep an eye on developments in our ear to the ground. With that being said, any legislative effort, whether from the PRB recommendations or the interim report, really have to be filed by March 12th, which is this session's bill filing deadline. After that, the only option, the main option, of course, is to move any recommendation onto a bill that's already been filed. So we're going to keep an eye on that. It is, they're noble efforts. Some of these recommendations are wanting to do good things, and some are, I think, are quite ambitious. But on that note, if anyone has any questions to that, we certainly will entertain.
Hey, Eddie, it's Armando Garza. Just real quick, just to clarify one thing you said. What's the bill filing deadline?
March 12th.
March 12th. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the question. And we can go to the next slide. I think it's the final slide. And there you go, Armando. The time frame we convened this week, bill filing deadline is March 12th. I think the legislature will likely get the data in time. The state and House districts need to be redistricted in a regular session. If they don't, it goes to the legislative redistricting board. I suspect that the legislature will come into special session to take care of the reapportionment of congressional seats based on the census data, and State Board of Education as well, which is a responsibility. So this regular session will adjourn May 31st, and it can't get here soon enough. But thank you for the time.
That's
Clint, back to you.
We appreciate, again, the opportunity to get to talk to you. We look forward to working on your issues. I think, as Eddie said, there will be some general pension issues, the bills that are filed. And one of the things that I'd like to emphasize again, we've seen kind of an evolution of the Pension Review Board, and we think they need to, the philosophy has always been they need to be remain as an advisory agency rather than an enforcement agency. And we'll be working with your board, you as the board, and Kelly and Josh on anything that comes up to get your direction on which way y'all want to go on it. And with that said, we don't. That's the end of our presentation. If there are any more questions, we'd be glad to entertain them.
Clint, this is Ken Haven again. One final question. This is for anybody. The pension, the anti-pension groups that have worked so hard against us in the past, like the John Laura Arnold Foundation, ALEC, and the Koch family, have they lost their luster, for lack of a better term, and have maybe shifted their focus elsewhere concerning the political climate today and said, you know, we haven't gotten much bang for our buck in trying to, you know, do away with pensions. Let's focus somewhere else, or do we still have to worry about that?
Well, there's already been a bill filed by a freshman member. He was elected in a special election. His name is Gates. He's down around Katy in that area. And he introduced a bill to switch all of the state funds into from a defined benefit plan out of that. The fiscal note on that would be astronomical, and there's no chance that that bill could pass. But, Ken, you know, I think we're always going to have to be diligent on that because there's people out there that just do not understand, first of all, the technicalities that would be involved in, and the expense to switch a defined benefit plan. But there are people, and we office right next door to a group that feels that that should happen, and that's the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and they haven't changed their mantra. And so it'll be out there, I think, for the next few years.
So, Ken, one thing I do want to point out, the Arnolds this session have so far spent most of their time working on bail bond reform and some criminal justice issues. That may get into another part of what we're interested in, but nonetheless, I'm hoping that if they see the twilight zone that we're faced with in the session, that they'll kind of focus all of their attention on the bail bond reform issue and lay off of us for a short period of while. But yeah, we've got to maintain vigilance.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I'd like to ask you guys to just hang on there for our next item. We're going to talk about the staff retirement plan and what legislative issues may be necessary as part of that. So if you got one or some of you could just stay on the phone till we get through that item, we would appreciate it.
We'll do it.
Okay, I think, are we ready to move on to the staff retirement plan issue? Let me just caveat or begin it by saying, you know, staff and the board, I think, is sensitive to the comments that Armando and David and Tina have made. And today, staff is recommending is not approval to join CRMS at all at this point in time. However, given the legislative constraints, the new bills need to be introduced by March 12th, and there's some timing that needs to be done in advance of that, the staff is recommending that they get the ability to go ahead and take actions to have the bill amended so that we have the flexibility to join if we decide to. They would like to move this, you know, the decision to actually whether or not that's the right plan or not would be pushed back a month or so, so that we can tie it in with the compensation review, with the total comp review that is being done next month. So, I mean, what we're looking for today is probably just approval to have the flexibility to join if we decide that's the right thing, and we also have the option not to join down the road if we don't conclude that that's the right plan. So with that, Kelly, do you want to give a summary of your presentation or cover whatever you plan to cover?
I do. Did you want to take the public comment before or after my comments? It might. I'll leave that up to you, before or after. I might be able to clarify some things if I speak first.
Well, why don't we do them after you've commented? That way they've heard your discussion as well and they can comment on that.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. So this presentation begins, John has it up. The first slide is 28. It starts, the agenda's on page 29. What I wanted to do, though, is to kind of start with what we're trying to do here. And what we're really trying to do is really simple, and it has taken on a life of its own. What we want to do is simply take the money that the pension system is already paying for the staff retirement plan and use that same money more effectively. So what we're looking to do here is take the contributions that the employees are making and that the system are currently making, that we pay every pay period into our Voya defined contribution plan, and instead put those into a balance at TMRS. That's really what we're talking about here. We're not talking about a defined benefit plan. Mr. Elliston, I think, mentioned a defined benefit plan. That's not what we're talking about here. A defined benefit plan, as you know, is like DPFP or ERF, where based on your years of service, you have your years of service and a multiplier and your salary, and based on that calculation, you have a lifetime guaranteed benefit amount. That is not what TMRS is. TMRS is similar to a defined contribution plan where however much money you put into that account, you, your employer, and the interest that it earns, when you go to retire, that is your pool. And they just, that's what you have to live on. It's no set guaranteed amount. It's based on whatever you've accumulated, just like a defined contribution plan. The difference between the defined contribution plan and what we're talking about here is really the guaranteed payment stream. So now in a defined contribution plan, you know, employee retires, they have this lump of money when they retire, and they can go out in the market and buy an annuity. That's very, very expensive, versus taking that same lump of money that they would have accumulated and having TMRS pay that out to you in an annuity. Much more cost effective. That's what we're talking about. So I apologize that this got confused and that it seems to be people are thinking we're looking for something additional or something different than we currently have. It's very, very similar to what we currently have. The other thing that Mr. Elliston brought up, and I have some of this on the slides, but I'm not going to go through each of the slides in detail, that I wanted to address is a couple of things. The legislation that we're looking at is to put us into the TMRS plan, and that legislative change is a comma and the words Dallas Police and Fire Pension System. That's it. That's all we need in the change. And what that would do is allow DPFP to be considered an entity that can participate in TMRS, just like the other it's 888 current member cities that are members. It would just put us in that pool of the 888 other cities. That's all we need. If we did a change to the DPFP legislation, that's a massive change because the plan is 118 pages throughout the whole thing. The concepts of police and fire and the police and fire departments and the chiefs and the disability and everything like that, line of duty disability, all of those things are incorporated throughout and would have to make a lot of change. So I just wanted to clarify those couple of things as we go. But just to hit some highlights that we talked about last time, John, if you can go to slide 30. So the goal of this, again, is to basically take the money we're already putting in the plan and convert that into a form that pays employees over their lifetime. So, you know, if they have a big balance or a little balance, whatever that is, it's divided over their expected life expectancy. That's what we're looking for here. This is more important for us because we are not in Social Security. So somebody that works for DPFP for their whole life doesn't have any sort of guaranteed payment. So if they invest very poorly or take their money all out when they retire and, you know, go to Tahiti because, you know, maybe they don't know better or something, they're not going to have anything to live on. We don't want to have that after somebody's dedicated their working years to DPFP. So that's this slide. On the next slide, John, if you can go to that. The history of why we got where we are and why this is an issue now when it wasn't an issue before. I just want to go over that a little bit. So in 2000, the system separated from the city, and the staff became what is referred to at that time as independent staff, meaning independent from the city. And what happened in 2000 was there was a study from this Campbell Consulting Group who looked at all of the ramifications of separating from the city, how you would do benefits and those types of things. Retirement was an issue. What were they going to do with retirement? So they decided and the board adopted to split from the city and create a defined contribution plan. But what they did do at the time is they allowed employees to decide if they were going to stay in the plan or if they were going to remain. Sorry, my dog's ringing the bell and it's confusing me. if they were going to stay in the ERF system until they met the retirement eligibility, or if they were going to separate from the city in 2000 and just become a DPFP employee at that time. 50% of the staff at that time decided to separate from the city. And 50% of the staff decided to remain in ERF. So what happened was they got to continue to earn their retirement, their full retirement, until they were moved over to DPFP and began accumulating their defined contribution plan. So what that meant is some of the employees in charge basically, stayed with the city until they met their full ERF defined benefit plan and then came over to the DPFP and got into this defined contribution plan, which in their minds was kind of like a drop on top of their defined benefit plan. All new employees, however, had to go directly into the defined contribution plan. And that's why we are where we are, why this wasn't an issue under Richard Tediment and Don Rowan and Everard and the staff that had ERF benefits before this, is because they had their city ERF defined benefit plan. If you go to the next slide, slide 32, The board adopted all of the recommendations from the study. One of that was that the system would provide a retirement and contribute to that defined contribution retirement to the same rates that the ERF was. That obviously hasn't continued. The ERF rates went way up. The DPFP rate stayed the same. We're not recommending putting more money into the DPFP plan. I just wanted to point that out. And the other thing is they specifically mentioned that this DC plan would be similar to a drop account for those employees that had their defined benefit earned by the city. Okay, John, can you go to the next slide? Let's see. So we've looked at solutions. As we know, we've had this on the board agenda several times. It's always been a difficult conversation. Getting into the defined contribution plan, like I mentioned, would be very complicated because of all of the places in the document that would have to change to do that. And in addition to that, it would be probably not advisable to open up that bill until we're ready to open up the bill and just correct a lot of things. So I wouldn't think that is a viable solution at this time. I would not recommend doing that. I'd recommend make no changes over doing that. Going into the Dallas employee retirement system would either require that we become city employees or it would require a change in their system. Did someone have a question? Okay. To change the ERF system to allow us to participate in that would require support of the ERF board, the city council, and a positive vote of the citizens of Dallas. So that doesn't appear viable. We did look at a staff defined benefit plan. There were problems with that. Although actuarially viable, we couldn't find a solution on where to put the assets. And the members had problems with that when we brought that up. So we came to TMRS. At first we said that's not possible because we don't meet the definition, but then realized it's just really a comma and adding the words Dallas Police and Fire Pension System to that legislation. So that's how we got where we are. Let's see. Next slide, please. TMRS, we've talked to them. I mentioned this last time. They are supportive of adding us, although they would like us to do a separate bill. Hilco would assist us, and as Mr. Ellison mentioned, we did reach out to Hilco, and we've talked to them about this possibility. Hilco works on a flat fee. They are not working They don't get paid based on the types of legislation that they're working on for us or the monitoring that they do. So whether that we're running this bill or not is not going to change the fee to Hilco this year. It is what it is. So I just wanted to point that out. I mentioned some of this before. So TMRS is a cash balance plan, not a defined benefit plan. You accumulate a balance when the balance is made up of, on the next slide, I think the next slide. So these slides that follow are cut and pasted from the member's guide because I wanted you to see from TMRS how they explain their benefits. And you can see the benefit is your contributions, interest, and the city matching funds. However much you've accumulated, whether that's a year of contributions when you retire, that's what your benefit is. You get a guaranteed interest amount of 5% that is lagged by a year. That is mentioned on the next slide, John. So basically, the example they have here is your balance at January 1, 2019 will be the interest that you earn at the end of 2019. So it's a lag, but it's 5%. And that 5% shouldn't be compared to the 5% in the drop. I think some people are making that comparison. That's not a fair comparison. The comparison should be what interest is a defined benefit plan assumed to have to develop the benefits? Because as you know, a defined benefit is based on city and employee contributions and interest. And ours was 8.5 before, it's currently 7. So that's more of a comparison. Okay, on the next slide, John. This talks about when can you retire. So yeah, their plan says most TMRS cities, you can retire after you at least have 5 years of service and are age 60. If you leave before you're vested, you lose you would lose your DPFP contributions if you leave before you're vested. But you could be deferred vested and wait until you're 60 if you meet that requirement to start drawing your benefits. But again, it's based on whatever pool you have accumulated. You can retire at 20 or 25 years. So there's different retirements. They're pretty consistent with other plans out there. And then you can select your monthly payment options. You can do, just based on your life, or you can buy a reduced benefit and cover beneficiaries and your survivors as well. Next slide, please. Okay, so TMRS does have options, and the options for contributions don't exactly match ours, the current DPFP contributions. So the board would have to select, if you decide to go into this plan, a contribution structure. So the TMRS options are the employee pays 5, 6, or 7%, and the city would pay, or the DPFP would pay 1 times, 1.5 times, or 2 times that. Whereas currently we're paying, employees paying 6.5, and DPFP is paying 12%, or basically 1.85%. So the board would need to decide to either keep the employee contribution, the employer contribution at 12%, which would mean the employee is 6%, so slightly less going into their overall account, but it doesn't cost the system anymore, or they could choose to have a little more from the system going in, but there's no requirement to do that. So the last slide, John, if you can go to that, kind of just attempts to show that in these two charts. The blue part is just the employer contribution amount, the 5, 6, and 7%. The DPFP contribution amounts, the 1, 1.5, 2 times, is going down the axis on the left. And then you can see, if, for example, if the employee is putting in 7% and you have 2 times, then obviously DPFP would put in 14%. The green box just combines the employer-employer rates. So, basically we'd probably land where my assumption is we would land at the 18%, which would be a combination of the employee 6% and the employer 2 times, which would be 18% versus the 18.5 going in. The other option would put it at 21%. So that's basically how it works, and I hope that helps clarify a little bit of what this is. Really what it is instead of taking the same money to buy a widget, we're buying a more effective widget at no additional cost. What questions can I answer?
Kelly? Trustee questions first. Yes. Go ahead.
I have a quick one, Chairman. This is Gilbert. Kelly, just to be clear, too, is number one, is there no concept of a COLA anywhere then? And number two, if all went well, so to speak, what would be the timing?
So that I believe in TMRS, there is an option for the employer to put in money for a COLA. We are not recommending that. If all goes well, if the legislation were to get passed, the bill would be effective September 1st of 2021, and I don't know what the transition time with TMRS would be. My assumption would be probably January 1, 2022.
Thank you.
Kelly, this is Ken. I have a question on if you looked into if you can buy your years of service. In other words, I'm going to use you as an example because I know exactly when you were hired. Would you be allowed to buy 6 years back to 2015 to show that you started in 2015 versus 2021?
So you can, it's not really, you're not really buying service, but you're getting credit for being, for time served. And yes, I've, it's kind of how it feels sometimes, but you're getting credit for the time that you have been with DPFP, but you're not getting any money for that. So if we were to go over to DPFP and somebody started in 2015, they would immediately be vested, which means, a month after, you know, we were in the plan and you left the system, you would be able to get your contributions and the employer contributions because you would already be vested at the time. But keep in mind, that would be one pay period or two pay periods worth of contributions. So you're only getting the dollars that you put in, and everybody's starting at zero. They've told us that we can't transfer our money from our Voya accounts and put them in there. So we all start with a zero balance. If you leave right away, you have zero, you know, and you just accumulate that over time. The only time that the only thing that prior experience with DPFP does is for vesting purposes.
Okay. And then what you mentioned Voya, would your plan be to keep Voya as an option, and not as an option, but to keep it as an extra savings plan for the employees and not do the match?
No. So we have a 457 that is totally voluntary, and there's no employer match to that. So we would keep the 457.
Okay.
We would have to talk to Voya about what we do with the existing Voya account, whether they kick us out because we won't be putting more money in, but there wouldn't be any more money going into Voya. But, you know, people have balances there. We have former employees that still have their money in Voya. We don't make them take it out, but we might have to look at if Voya won't allow us to keep it if people have to buy IRAs and move it out some other way. But no new money would be going into Voya, the 401A.
Any more trustee questions?
I don't know. This is a question. This is more like a statement. Okay.
Okay.
Just to put some nuance on all of this, we, Armando and myself were asked to get a barometer from the members and non-members, retirees. While it's not technically an augmented benefit because the outlay is the same, but in the end, there is something better coming out of it. It has a perception of being more. And because of that, and because of the timing of all of this, especially after coming off of COVID, and especially because it was also presented to us as a time-sensitive thing, meaning that if it wasn't going to get passed in this vote, then they had to wait 2 years. And in this conversation, it looks like we at least had another month to discuss it before we would have to make an appropriate vote. And it is this process that is very frustrating for people behind it. While this doesn't need member approval, and I understand that, and as trustee, however, you need to understand that 12.5 for the defined contribution plan is coming out of the pension. Salaries are coming out of the pension. So if you don't at least make sure that the information is communicated properly to the people who are watching, then there is a lot of misinformation, misunderstanding, and it becomes a heated situation. When it comes to benefits of staff, the history has been that there's always some back door and there's something going on that is a distrust, an overall distrust. So full transparency in this process is essential. Now, I think, Kelly, you did a great job in explaining it this time around, but there were still a lot of questions when we were actually getting this litmus test with the regular bank. And my frustration is, and I've asked, that this vote be held one more month because apparently it is not a drop-dead deadline. Because we have a March 15th. We had another month where we could at least articulate the information correctly to the base. And why is that important? Because you misunderstand how a hot button this is, okay? When you have a discussion like this, because of misinformation, because it's not properly understood, and because there might be questions, and when you have a group that tends not to always agree, i.e. members, active members, retirees, the Latinos, the African-American, the local 58, when you have all those groups in concert saying, whoa, 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 wait, the ramifications behind that is that you don't realize they have lobbyists. And with misinformation, with poor misinformation, without complete information, they will kill it on the floor. So my thing is, why can't we just make sure that the information is properly disseminated to everybody, make sure that there's no harm, no foul. It is simply the same amount of money. We don't want a defined contribution plan, i.e. everybody in DPSC knows what a defined contribution. It was a hotbed, 2017, so they get that. But the communication needed to be better. The information needed to be parceled in a way. And then when you stick it through and say, this is the last time before 2 years, it doesn't feel good. Okay? And so my issue has been, let's just wait a second. Because we were asked to kind of get this idea. We shook those trees. Those trees are shaken now. And now we just wanted to say, okay, hold up. I don't think the trustees understand what a hot topic this is. And all it really, and it didn't need to be this way, it didn't need to be a big conflict like this way, because it's really a very simple, I think, miscommunication. One of the biggest things that was asked is, why aren't they getting Social Security? They're only getting something more like a 401k. And the concept that, and I want to be clear about this, the concept that members or retirees are acting like sour grapes, i.e. we have bad stuff, so the staff shouldn't get good stuff, is not right. It's not okay. They are simply asking for more information, and that is not inappropriate. And this is where we've come to.
Okay, thanks, Tina. Okay, is there any other trustees that want to add anything before we open it up and get any public comments?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Go ahead, Armando.
Thank you, Steve. Hey, I just want to clarify a couple of things. Never once did I ever say that I was against the staff getting a pension. Never once did I ever say that. All I've asked from day one is to have a total compensation study where we can see the entire benefit package. To this point, we still don't have that information. The members want to be able to see, the members that fund this opportunity want to be able to make an informed decision. They're not against it. They just don't have enough information to be able to support it and sell it to their members. We don't know if our rank and file staff are paid below market, at market, or above market. We have to be able to balance things out. They want to make sure that it's a good deal for the rank and file members of the staff, of DPFP staff. They're not against it. They just don't have enough information. We haven't sold this. We haven't done the groundwork that needs to be done to make sure that they understand what we're asking of them. And that's where the confusion and the reluctance is coming from. We, like Tina said, we've been asked to go out and get the pulse of the members, and we did that. And there was more questions than answers. So I just wanted to be clear that I'm not against our staff. I think our staff does a wonderful job. I think given the situation that they've been put into, to have to deal with a bunch of angry policemen and firemen, I think they do a great job. And I think that they deserve a pension. But I want to make sure we get it right, and I want to make sure we get it right from the very beginning. And to feel like we're being rushed in to make a decision and have to come up with a solution, we have until March the 12th to file a bill. We still have two more meetings. We have a meeting in February, and we have a meeting in March. So I am respectfully requesting that we get the total compensation package, have a presentation on it, bulk it all together, and then we figure out how we need to proceed. That's all I have to say. Thank you all.
And I just want to make one more comment. Again, I just want to – I'm going to almost say exactly what one of the association leaders said to me. He said, we're not against that. We're not against a better pay package. We should have the best paid staff because we have the biggest problems. They actually said, we understand that they may need more money or more benefits, but we just want to understand how that happened. They are not against, and I want to be very clear about that, because nobody is against having a better retirement system that you have lifetime benefits. Nobody is. And nobody's saying that you're doing a bad job. And to just say, wait one second, let me get more information, to say, well, no one appreciates us, that should not ever be taken away from this either. It's just about communication, transparency, and information. That's all it is. And a process. We always love processes. Let's put a process in place that when you're changing something, you have to check this, a cost analysis, an entirety, a full transparency, and the efforts to push it through. That's all. That is all.
Okay. One comment I'd make, we don't meet in March until March 11th, so that March is off the table as far as I'm concerned. So February is the issue, and we'll get back to this in a minute, but I think all we're asking for today is the ability to start the process so that we have that flexibility to decide in February whether or not we want to pursue that. But having said that, John, see if anybody in the public wants to add a comment before we move on.
And Bill, before we do that, this is Steve. I did want to echo what Armando and Tina said, and then to remind the board that I was able to touch base with – Kelly put me in touch with the compensation consultant, and I agreed. I think we have to be have the utmost transparency and show the process that we're following. And we're not looking at we're not necessarily saying no to this, but we're also not looking at this decision in a vacuum. It's part of a bigger picture of what we're doing for the staff with compensation, with their medical plan, and everything else that goes into it, because we do value the staff and need to retain that staff. But I'm working on that. Armando and Rob French are going to help me with that as well. And I would anticipate we would have something for the board to review in February to allow that transparency and to facilitate decision making.
This is Alan. Can I hop in and add something, please?
Yes, please.
I hear what Steve and Armando are saying, and the concerns raised by David at the beginning of the meeting. But just from a practical point of view, I just want to remind everyone that if this amendment gets done by the legislature, which, as Buddy and his team explained, is going to be tough this session, given what's going on, even if it gets changed, this board still has to make the decision at a later time whether or not to do it. And so that brings us to the whole legislative process. Now, Texas is a state with 28 million people, but our legislature meets once every 2 years for about 6 months, whereas states like Mississippi with 3 million people meet every year. Our system is designed to not get legislation passed, and to get something passed is difficult. And, yeah, you know, the bill filing deadline is what it is, but it's better to have something filed sooner in order to get it through the committee hearing processes. And, as Buddy explained, right now we have in the House, for example, the regular committee, then a calendars committee. It has to clear before it ever even gets to the floor. Now there may be a third committee. So I'm just saying that maybe we go ahead and get the ball rolling on this so we have that option on the table, because waiting until the longer we wait, the more difficult it is to have this option in place should we decide to enact it down the road. So that's my only comment on
Alan,
not waiting.
And my response to that is it gets dead on arrival if you have every single association lobbyist down there. That's my issue. Just have support. Just even if it takes a little bit more challenge, the difference is if you have all the association support, because we've actually said we want them to understand. If they come down there and support this, that's something very different. And it's not impossible that they won't support it. It's just that they should be part of the acceptance of it. If they go down, as you say, and it's that difficult, and you have a concert of lobbyists on behalf of, you know, both police and fire, retirees and members, and say, no, this is an absolute no, then that's never going to work. And all I'm simply saying is that, yes, it's going to be a little bit more difficult but we're asking for that, because then we get a buy-in on the other side, because we've actually shown them why it's good. We've shown them why it's not going to be more for them. That's all I'm saying. You have to really, if you think the trustees are going to just say, okay, let's go it down, and then it goes to the floor, and then you create a bigger problem, because now you have a strife between all of the members and the staff, and I want to avoid that, because it doesn't have to happen. It doesn't have to happen.
Well, can I just... counter argument to that is that by filing it, we are being more transparent, and then look, everyone is clearly aware this is an issue out there, right? I hear everyone's concerns. I'm just saying, from a practical point of view of getting legislation passed, the longer you wait, the less likely it is. And if we want to have this option open to us, and I think everyone agrees it's an option we want to have open, whether or not we do it down the road, I just think we should act sooner than later.
And if we could, Bill, this is Gilbert. Obviously, it's much easier to kill a bill than pass one. I think we all know that. I don't think we should be prisoner to the cycle of our board meetings, because we can always call a special board meeting. So I just want to throw that out there as well, because we want to do things, right.
Hey, this is Ken. I agree 100% with Gilbert. In the past, we've always had the opportunity, and we have called special board meetings. And I don't have a problem with taking Kelly's presentation today, getting it out there to everybody and saying, okay, let us know your final comments. Let us know what you think. And in 2 weeks, we all meet by Zoom, so it's not like we have to physically drive to location or fly to location. Let's get it out there. Let's get the information to them. And then in 2 weeks, let's have a special meeting just to deal with this, and then let's get rolling on it.
I agree. That's all I'm asking. I'm asking for time.
I can support that.
No, it's 2 weeks. I don't think we need to wait a month. I think, 2 weeks would be fine.
Okay, let's
Alan, that sounds reasonable to me.
On the public wants to comment before we bring this to a head.
If let's press 5-star, that'll raise your hand, and I'll unmute you for comments.
Any comments, John?
Yeah. Phone number ending in 3877.
Okay, that's me. Hi, my name's Jim McDade. I'm president of the Dallas Firefighters Association. We represent about 1,500 active members, and we do work hand-in-hand with our retired firefighters association. So a couple comments here. First off, thank Kelly for explaining, for going through that presentation. Definitely understand this a lot more than I did over the past few days. Overall, as a labor leader and as somebody who's a member of the police and fire pension system, the idea of making sure that the employees of the system are well compensated and really being the best compensated pension employees, that just ensures that we have the best employees working for the pension system. So looking at some sort of a plan that offers stability and that offers stability for the employees, no problem with that at all. Let me jump back on one thing. Adding staff to the police and fire pension system, that's an absolute no for us. The pension system is designed for uniform members only. We would never support allowing somebody who's not a uniform member into our pension. And even putting them back into the Dallas employees retirement system, we would be against that because of we don't want them to be city employees. We like the separation that they do have for a lot of reasons, but we'd be against both of those. So the TMRS option is a good option, I think, and it is something to look at. What we don't like right now is the timing of all of this. We're up against legislative session, technically began a couple days ago. We should have had this presentation months ago, along with the compensation study that's coming next month. We should have already been having these discussions, already gone through this, already had a plan where we could go in hand with the associations, along with the pension system down in Austin, and getting something done if we decided this was the direction we needed to go. Because this is this was discussed in 2019, I believe it was, and it was tabled at that point. We haven't heard anything about it since then. So the timing is the biggest issue that we have. So, and I know, like Hilco has said, this is going to be a very weird legislative session. In talking with our lobbyists, it's going to be very difficult, even more difficult than normal, to get bills passed and to get things through. So getting this through at this point is going to be an issue. And we're up against it. This should have already been filed. We should have had this discussion already. We should have had a decision already, and this should already be taken care of. But overall, the idea of making sure that the employees of the pension system are well compensated and taken care of so we are able to retain and attract the best employees. It's the same thing we said for members of police and fire departments. We want to be able to attract and retain the best employees. That goes for the pension system, too, because y'all's job is to take care of our money and to take care of our futures, and we want to make sure that's done. So with that, thank y'all for the time. Thanks for the discussion today.
Thank you. Okay. John, anybody else? Or?
Yeah, we have another one. Phone number entering in 0261. You also should have gotten an alert that you were unmuted.
Sorry about that, guys. This is Mike Mott. I'm president of the Dallas Police Association, and I represent just over 2,700 active uniformed employees. And I just want to echo just a little bit of what Jim McDade, my counterpart, said. I find it very disturbing that, the first time I'm hearing of this and this new action is really this week. This should have been a conversation that we should have had months ago. I think it's not going to be a hard sell to members if they had the appropriate information, because I'm going to tell you today, walking in this morning prior to Kelly's points and Kelly's PowerPoint, I was a dead fast no. After looking at some of her points, getting a little bit clearer picture, I agree. I think it's a viable option. I agree with Jim that in no way would I want them to be a part of our pension. And again, I concur with him. In no way do I want them to work for the city. They jack up enough as it is. But this needs to be communicated much better, because what I think y'all fail to understand is we've got a lot of hurt people who are members, and they will look at any action, especially any action that's done quickly, that's done without informative information, that's going to educate them to what's real and what's not real, because you know how cops and firefighters love rumors. It will blow up. And the problem is you guys aren't going to have to answer the phone. I'm going to have to answer the phone, and the other presidents are going to have to answer the phone. And they're not going to like the answer of, well, I didn't know, or I wasn't informed. So it will, that we would be forced to kill it on the floor. It will not make it to a calendar. So I agree 100% with Jim that I think we ought to have the best possible employees that we can have. I believe in a fair and even above compensation, so that we maintain those employees and so that we can bring back our pension to where it needs to be. But when you got somebody who's going to look at this right off the top and say, hey, wait a minute, they took from me and now we want to give to them, without them being educated of exactly what is being offered to them, we're going to be forced to go against it. And I don't want to do that. So I think we should get more information out there. I think it needs to be presented by the pension and not by myself or any other president. I think we should be there with you if we agree to it. But this needs to be proposed by the pension to the members.
Thank you, Mike. Okay. Can we go back to our session, please?
John, do you have any more in the queue?
No, I don't see any right now.
Okay, let's go back. It sounds to me like, you know, that we need a little more time, and whether we do it in a special meeting or whether February. How much time would it take to put the information and get it out to the people? I mean, is that, somebody said, Armando, I think, that 2 weeks would work, 2 or 3 weeks? Is that?
I actually think a week, but with 2 the max.
Okay, and what about the comp study, Kelly? When would that be ready? Could we have a special meeting that would cover both the comp study as well as this issue?
I'm not sure. I need to get with Steve and the consultant that's working on a comp study to see where we are, what more we might need. So I don't know if that would be ready in 2 weeks or not. I can't really say.
Okay, we
could shoot for that.
I think it will be. I think it, and again, Bill and the trustees, I'm doing this, you know, we can actually have this in 2 weeks. I can make a commitment to all of you to work on this and have this done for you, along with Armando and Rob. We'll have this done.
Okay, let's.
And this is Alan. I'm available to help any of the board members or any of our constituent members visiting with their teams about this, just on the legislative process side of it and the timing.
Okay, thank you, Alan. Okay, let's tentatively plan on trying to bring these both back together and having a special meeting in 2 weeks, say on the 28th roughly, and let's make that part of the plan, and then we can cover this hopefully at that time. Any further
that
discussion before we move on to the next item? Okay. Kelly, you're up with the monthly contribution report.
Yes, thank you. And thank you to Hilco for staying on. We thought it would be helpful that you hear the conversation just so you get an idea of what the members are thinking as well if this ends up moving forward. So I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you all.
Thank you. So the next item is on your screen. John has put it up there, which is great because I can't find it in mine to find the page number. Okay, page 42. This is the contribution report for January of 2021. It's based on November of 2020 data. So you will not see in this report or even the next report the new increase in the floor until we get into the actual data for January, because there's a lag in this report. The movement from October to November was positive. The membership increased by 118 employees over that time, or 119 employees, I'm sorry. In a prior report, they were below the hiring estimate by 89 employees. And this report, they're actually over the estimate by 30 people. So that's a positive 119-person increase. The contributions are right on target. On page 43, you see that on that first line there, the contributions based on actual comp pay was just slightly under the floor by $7,656, so just almost equaling the floor. It was 109% of the hiring plan. And since the inception of House Bill 3158, we have the comp pay at 92% of the floor and 100% of the hiring plan. So everything is still going in the right direction at this time. Are there any questions on this report?
Okay.
Okay.
You've got the next couple of items, Kelly, so why don't you just kick?
Okay. So the next item is the board approval of the trustee and education and travel. That's on page 48. There's no new additions to this report, no requests. So unless somebody wants to add something now, we don't need a motion for this item. Okay. Hearing nothing, I'll move on. The next two items are actually, one is for actuarial service and one is for legislative services. And they're basically the same type of item, so I will take them together, although the motions are a little bit different. So in 2015, the board gave direction that the staff conduct a competitive selection process anytime that we are with one of our service providers that provides services to the board for more than 5 years. And if we're not going to do that competitive selection process, we need explicit direction from the board not to do so. So at this time, both Hilco and Siegel have hit their 5-year mark. So has BDO, by the way, for the audit services. We are doing a competitive selection process for audit services right now. But I'm recommending for the actuarial services and the legislative services that we don't make a change at this time. And the reason for that is, as you know, in the legislation, there is the requirement in 2024 that we do an analysis and go back with changes if necessary. So I think it's important that we're consistent with both the actuary and the legislative consultants through the for the actuary through the end of 2025 and through the for the legislative consultants through the end of the 2025 legislative session. So what I'm requesting is that we authorize that we're authorized to renew the contracts with both of these groups and not do a competitive selection process until the end of 2025, basically. And the board can change that direction at any time if you become dissatisfied with the service providers. Are there questions or concerns about either of these two?
This is Mark Malvo. I will vote in favor of this, but I am with a huge caveat. I'm not quite certain how we got to the point where this is happening at this time. I don't like the fact that someone's been in a position for 5 years and there is not going to be any kind of process by which we can look at other firms. I don't think that's a good route. However, I understand the position that we're in today, but I'm not a supporter of not going after competitive for some form of process to see who's out there.
Okay, anybody else want to make any comments?
Well, for me, this is Gilbert. I don't want to be the always the Lone Ranger, but I'm going to vote against it, and not because of what we don't want to do or this or that, but I don't know. I'd like to test the market on fees. I'd like to test those sorts of things, and I think it's a healthy exercise. So I'm not trying to be a troublemaker, but that's where I fall.
if that's the direction of the board, we're fine to do that. But just to explain a little bit, I mean, going into the 2017 legislative session, we spent, thousands of hours with Siegel running models and different scenarios and different options and all that. And so this, to me, with Siegel is not about losing, not about fees or level of service. This is about the institutional knowledge that I'm trying to protect. But if the board wants to do a search, I'm certainly happy to do that. And on the legislative consultants, we found that in the 2017 legislative process, Hilco had all the connections that we needed, and they were very effective. So, that's the recommendation. I totally agree that in a normal situation that it's important to switch out your consultants, and that's why we're moving forward with BDO. But, I mean, if the board wants to move forward, we can certainly do or have us do a selection process. We certainly can do that. It's just we're in this weird time right now where institutional knowledge, I think, is important for us.
Okay, why don't we go ahead?
I appreciate that.
Does somebody want to, let's take them separately. The actuarial services as far as Siegel first. The recommended motion was to authorize the executive director to renew the contract and waive the requirement to conduct a competitive process until the end of the term of the contract, December 31, 2025. Does somebody want a motion approval of that?
I'll make the motion. It's Nick.
Thank you, Nick. Do we have a second?
I'll second. This is Ken.
Okay, Ken, second. Probably going to be easier. Anybody opposed? If you oppose, please state so.
This is Gilbert. I do.
Mr. Chairman, this is Rob. I do as well.
Okay. Anybody else? That would mean approval of 9-2 approval of this motion. Now let's take Hilco separately. Same thing. Does anybody want a motion to renew the Hilco contract under the current terms? 2 years.
This is Michael Brown. This is Michael Brown. I'll do it.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. Do we have a second?
Alan, second.
Alan, second. Again, anybody opposed? Please state who it is.
Yeah, I, this is Gilbert. I oppose for the reason I mentioned. I know they do a great job, but it's just a principle.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is Rob. Echoing what Gilbert said, just think it makes sense to shop out. And even if we're looking for institutional stakeholders, I mean, that's part of the calculus when you weigh people versus their competitors. So I'm against not shopping this out.
Okay. I will point out that I think it was 2 years ago, we used to have two consultants. We cut one out because of budgetary concerns and things of that nature, and this got contracted. But thank you for your thoughts. Okay, anybody else opposed before we close this one? If not, okay, this also approved 9-2 then, Kelly. Thank you. Okay, we are now ready to go to the portfolio update. Kent's been waiting anxiously, I'm sure.
Thanks, Bill. My comments will be relatively brief today, so be sure and shout out if you've got particular questions on any of these slides. And John, you read my mind. You're already on slide 54. Thank you. And so just a couple things to point out here. On the second row from the bottom, second column, you'll see the 303. That's how much we have in the safety reserve at the end of December, versus a target of about 30 months of cash, net cash flow, so of 270. So we're a little bit heavy there. We knew that we would be heavy because of our decision to liquidate the global bond portfolio back in November. If you look over on the far right under variance, about halfway down, you'll see that minus 75. That is the global bonds where we've had a zero balance versus the target. And we're going to address that as we get into the allocation study, asset allocation study, later in the first quarter. And so, half of that has been used for filling up the investment grade bonds, and then we'll use it for cash flow as needed. That's about it on this slide. Moving to the next slide on performance estimates. Kind of a lot of the same story here. I do want to point out that, as I mentioned last time, the partners, Boston Partners, is kind of coming back. Its value has been outperforming recently. So they had a good quarter, you know, still down for the year. And global equity underperformed slightly overall for the year. You know, I'll mention that global equity outperformed by 209 basis points, estimated 209 basis points last year. So, it's they kind of didn't give it all back, which is good. Fixed income, if you stay on that far right column, you'll see that it's down 257, which is more of an allocation issue. It's that short-term kind of being included, which weighs us down. So all the managers did pretty well. Even Brandywine and the global bonds really did an admirable job of kind of coming back after their drawdown in the first quarter. That's really all I have to say on this slide. Moving forward on investment activity, as always, a lot of focus and a lot of energy being spent on the private markets. Ryan will talk a little bit about quite a bit more about that here in a moment or later. Investment advisory committee meeting we held on the middle of December, right in the week after the board meeting. So we talked about global equity there. Actually, on global equity, we initially made a recommendation to the investment advisory committee early in December, and they had some concerns about securities lending in the fund we had recommended. So we were in the middle of reevaluating at that meeting. Later in January, we made another recommendation, which they have supported, and we'll be talking about that later as well. The Loomis High Yield Account transitioned to the benchmark aware U.S. high yield profile. So a little bit of administrative work, actually not much trading involved, but quite a bit of administrative work to make that happen. So that was all done. And a shout out to Mike Yen, who kind of took care of all that, and it went well. We've had on the kind of to-do list for a while reviewing the investment policy, and so we've gone through that. There's a few kind of cleanup items and things that we want to maybe say a little bit differently, but nothing that's urgent, and so there was really no reason to kind of bring that up separately this time. So we'll look for – we'll probably have some changes coming up in the next meeting or two, so we'll have kind of changes throughout whenever we do that. And on deck – we're going to talk here in a moment to kind of just revisit the global equity structure, but we anticipate we'll be spending more time on search for U.S. and non-U.S. small cap managers. I think that hits it here. The next slide is just the investment review plan, and we'll start off with the real estate later in this session. So any questions on the portfolio update? Okay. I think our next item on the agenda, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'll ask maybe turn it over to Gilbert.
Go ahead.
He wants to lead us off on the Investment Advisory Committee.
Thank you, Kent. So the Investment Advisory Committee met, and we also had a couple of two board members as guests. And I think the most important things are, the first, we've asked the staff just to do some maintenance. And what I mean by that is just to check that all the managers, that everything's in line between what the contract says the index is, what the guideline says the index is, all the investment policy statement, just so we can get away from these sorts of dialogues around growth, value, and what's stylistically happening. Because at the end of the day, if they're given an index, they've got to beat it, regardless. And so we're just going to double check on all that. That's number one. Number two, we want to bring a recommendation to the board, the full board, which is we want to make the investment advisory committees now subject to the same open meetings provisions that the board has. And for the history, when we first set up the investment advisory committee, there was some dialogue around it, and I'm not throwing a stone at anybody. I was for it being open then, but there are reasons people felt not, and that's the direction that was chosen. But now, I'm the chairman now, and I wanted to bring it back up. I think that it's important that if we're doing the people's business and the beneficiary's business, that they have a right to have access to the information, and they have a right to participate or not if they choose not. I don't think it will cause any issues related to if people will be less willing to say something or more. That was established by all the members saying it wouldn't prohibit them from speaking their mind. It might be a little bit more work for the staff, but I think that's the price of transparency and democracy, and I think that's a good thing. And so we really want to make sure the board approves that. I don't know if we need a motion or not, Mr. Chair, but that's what we would like to do as the Investment Advisory Committee. So what that means is posting with notice, subject to FOIAs, all of the things that a regular board meeting has, and all of those things. So those are really the main highlights I have. I'll let Kent talk about some of the portfolio issues, but I wanted to bring up those two things, just the maintenance of checking guidelines and so forth, and the other is the Investment Advisory Committee becoming a public meeting and then now subject to the open meetings and everything else.
Okay. Kelly and Josh, can you comment on that, on that recommendation?
From a workload issue, we can work with that. We'll build the posting requirements and stuff into our timeline, but I would like Josh to talk about the differences between how open meetings would work for this group versus the board and just the nuances there, Josh.
Right. So I think that there's a couple of issues that were raised here. One, I think it's in your discussion sheet revolving around, I think the IAC was very specific that they, as Gilbert said, nobody was particularly opposed to having the meetings in public. That didn't seem to bother people. I think the only issue was whether the meetings would then provide the ability for the public to make public comments. And I think it's pretty clear under the statute that as long as a quorum of the board is not present for the meeting, that is not a type of body that would require under the Open Meetings Act of public comments. So I think that issue, if it's structured that way, would not pose a problem for what the IAC has said. The other issue, which is a little more difficult, is, and again, perhaps it's a non-issue if people are not going to participate, but the number of trustees who are on the board currently who would participate in those meetings, and there's been interest in the past, and we've talked about it in the past, and I think my general reading of the statute, of the IAC requirement, is that these, and this is how we've been proceeding, is that these meetings be conducted where there's more outside non-trustee members than sitting trustees. So I think if these were public meetings, I think that's fine, and we can accomplish it under the statute as long as there were strictures in place to make sure that those limits stayed in place so that there were more outsiders than insiders. And I think, to Gilbert's question, I think to me it would be, as you discuss this and decide how to go forward, I think it would be good and good practice and important to put in these rules into the investment policy statement exactly how the IAC meetings are to be held. So I think those are just the two sort of issues that I would say keep in mind as you decide how to make this go forward, how to structure this going forward.
Now, right
and
now,
Mr. Chairman, what I would propose is that we get approval from the board to make it an open meeting. I mean, open committee. It's subject to the same provisions, and then let Josh and the staff, and if need be, any outside lawyers, cross the T's and dot the I's on how to do it and the proper disclosure. I think we can figure that out.
And currently, we have three trustees on the committee. Is that right, Gilbert? You're on the committee. Ken's on the committee, and somebody else.
Michael Brown.
Okay, Michael. So we, with three trustees, we could not have another three trustees attend the meeting without being subject to what our rules are, I believe. Is that correct?
Is that correct, Josh?
Yeah, well, you could. So let me there's a couple things. One, assuming you agree with my view that you have to have more outsiders than insiders, and I think we have I don't remember now. We have four or five outsiders. I think it's four now. Correct? Am I right?
I think it's four also.
Yep.
Yeah. So we could have. You could not have. More, you know, you could not have additional trustees attend the meetings. That's correct, assuming everybody was attending the IAC.
This is Mark Nalvo. I have a question on that, because unless there's something particular about the statute for this fund, there are other, Josh, there may be something I'm missing, but there are other entities that have committee meetings that are open to the public, subject to the Open Meetings Act, where that is not the case. So I'm curious as to, for example, DFW Airport has committee meetings on Tuesdays. People are there or not there. It doesn't have a bearing on whether you are running afoul of the Open Meetings Act. So I'm a little curious as to why this would be different.
Yeah, and on that note, if I could, my experience is the same. It's just a function of if there's a decision by the IAC, any other board members that are non-IAC members just do not have a vote.
So the answer to your question, Mark, is that our statute is very specific in that it requires that the IAC have more outside members than sitting trustees. So we have followed that statute to make sure that the meetings are conducted with more outsiders than sitting trustees. We have very specific language. I understand what you're saying. There's lots of pension boards and endowments and pension systems that have investment committees, but we just have very specific language coming out of the 2017 changes that was intentionally to make sure that outsiders were the majority on the committee. So that's what's driving that.
So you don't think by having the vote, as I described, satisfies that? Where there are members that are outside, and that any trustees that visit that are non-voting members are in fact non-voting members?
No, I don't think so. I think if they're deliberating, I don't think that gets you within the spirit and intent of the statute.
Okay.
Can I ask a question? Are investment advisory committees usually conducted in a public forum?
Every board I have had is.
So basically you show how the sausage is being made before the sausage comes out. I'm just curious because I just want to know because there are definitely tough decisions that need to be made on this in this fund, that like full disclosure, even pontificating or just kind of coming up with ideas, if the public is just going to be like outraged or like, you know, toying with some ideas. I don't know. It just seems like I'm all about transparency.
That's not the way. That's not the way those committees work, and the way we do it here, at least from my limited experience dealing with governmental entities and funds, is that we're kind of special here in doing non-public investment committees.
Oh, okay. I didn't know
right.
that.
Yeah, and think of it this way. You know, the U.S. Congress is going through a very difficult time, and it's all public, and it's terrible sausage, but it's public, you know, because they represent us. And if you think about the money, it belongs to the beneficiaries and the workers. And as far as the plan sponsor, well, it's the taxpayers that foot the bill. So no one should be worried about anything unless they're doing something they shouldn't be doing, frankly. And so that's why it's open. And now there may be times there are things that fall under the where you know kick everybody out, et cetera, because it's closed session. And that might be the case here, too, where we talk about an item that is under litigation, you know, all the rules, litigation, employment issues, et cetera. And it would fall under the same parameters.
Okay. Josh, we don't need a motion. We can provide direction that we move in that direction to make these open meetings and that you'll resolve what the rules may be for those trustees who are not members of the IAC as far as attendance, whether they're able to attend or not, and as we move down this road. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think we can come back with changes, with proposed changes to the investment policy statement. That's correct.
Okay. Gilbert, anything you'd want to add at this stage?
No, other than I thank the board. I think it's a good thing, and I think it goes a long way for what the earlier discussion about building trust and everything else with the whole ecosystem of this plan. So thank you.
Okay, great. Kent, are you going to take us through the global equity structure and passive investment manager?
Yeah, I'm going to start it off, and then I'll hand it over to Greg Earlbeck. And first, I just wanted, just before we leave the Investment Advisory Committee, just wanted to mention to the board, the draft minutes of the most recent meeting are included in your packet on page 174. And I'm sure you've looked at those already. And were there any questions about anything else from the Investment Advisory Committee? If not, then I'll move forward and just talk about global equity. And so you'll see at the bottom of slide 59, we actually have three separate recommendations that we're requesting approval on. And I'll take us through the first one. Excuse me one second. I'll take us through the first one, which is the structure. And so if you can turn to the next slide, John, slide 60. And so we had a discussion and a presentation from Nikita last time and recommendations regarding the global structure. And we need the board to approve the structure because asset class structures need to be approved by the board by the investment policy. And so we've kind of just summarized that right here. And then we note in the implementation that this structure includes small cap, and so we would anticipate future contributions. You know, once the we would rebalance down the current managers to the kind of 7% of the total fund target, and then future contribute that would kind of already overweight the index fund. And then we would put additional funds in there as we were getting liquidations from private markets until we were ready to deploy into the small cap. So that would be kind of the general intention here. But what we're really looking for is approval of the structure. And Mr. Chair, if we could cover that now, that would be great.
One question I had, it's structure, but it's also hiring a manager. I mean, as you know, a lot of these indexes now have weightings in China with companies that are now on the no invest list from the government. How are we going to handle that with an index fund? Because from what I've seen in other index funds, they tend to invest on a very passive basis, and they haven't solved this problem yet.
We'll look into that specifically. And I'm aware of kind of some of the directions for government, for U.S. government funds to be restricted in what they can invest in China and other issues that are kind of outstanding. There's nothing that's impacting DPFP yet, or it appears kind of imminent. And then so for any divestment rules, a lot of times that applies, could apply to a separate account but may not apply to a fund. But and then, of course, the fund will have to apply abide by any, laws of the United States. But I think Nikita is on the phone with us, so I'll just ask if they have any additional perspective on that. Okay. Thought Leah was going to be on.
Check with Northern Trust.
Anyway.
This has become a bigger issue.
I am sorry. I was muted. I didn't realize I was speaking muted. Good
Go
morning,
ahead,
everybody. This is Leo. It is a pretty fluid situation still. We, you know, get updates from some of my colleagues in the research side. On the Chinese holdings and the fixed income side, it mostly affects emerging market strategies. Even then, it's a very small subset. We have the list of the communist Chinese military companies. We haven't come across any meaningful impact to any managers we work with. And let me see. And even on the equity side, it's been pretty small. So I can try to get be more specific. I mean, I can provide the list of the holdings, but so far it's marginal and definitely not an impact on the fixed income side, and on the equity side, I can try to confirm if there would be any issues, but I don't envision that.
If you can get back to us next month, and I think you need to talk probably to Northern Trust, if that's who we end up hiring, just to see how they're dealing with that issue.
Yeah,
this is
Northern Trust. On January 11th, so it's brand new. There is this divestment must be completed by November 11th, 2021. So there's certainly time. So we'll come back at the next meeting and provide more specificity on this issue. But the good news is that there is time.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
This is Greg. I was going to let you know the MSCI did drop the three Chinese telecom companies from their all-country world benchmarks. We'll talk to Northern Trust to find specifically of how they're tracking it, but I would expect that they would remove those from the index fund as well. Those three companies were about 0.1% of the ACWI index.
Okay, let's
thank you, Greg. Mr. Chair, can we go ahead and approve the structure here?
Okay. Do you want to do that, or can we come back and do all three at the same time after we go through it? We'll do them.
We can do them all. So with that, all at the same time. So I'll turn it over to Greg to walk us through the recommended passive manager.
Good.
Thank you. John, if you could go to 62, please. I'm sorry, go back one. So during Q4 2020, staff did work with Nikita and also with the IAC to evaluate potential passive global equity managers. All in, we looked at BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, and Northern Trust. In December, we had been leaning towards BlackRock and presented that to the IAC. The IAC expressed a preference for a fund that did not participate in securities lending. So we went back and kind of did a deep dive on BlackRock's securities lending and also looked at State Street and Northern Trust as non-lending products. And in the end, after the review and analysis, we'll be recommending Northern Trust for the passive manager. We also worked with Makita regarding the process. They did provide a blind RFI process and got a list of potential candidate dates. We looked at the fees. They also helped us look at kind of some of the key metrics to evaluate passive index providers. And some of those are going to be one of the primary ones, of course, is being the fees, the type of vehicle it is, the liquidity, and trade notice and settlement, and then, of course, whether or not it's securities lending. So if you go to the next page, please. If we look at the top fund comparison chart, the structure of all of these, with the exception being Vanguard, are basically commingled investment trusts. If we look at kind of Northern Trust, is a winner with regards to the management fee at 4 basis points. Another thing that's attractive about Northern Trust is that they actually cap their administrative fees at 1.75. And we're actually running a little bit lower than that at 1.41. And then they also had a shorter trade notice at trade date minus one. BlackRock and Vanguard were both participating in securities lending, and then Northern Trust and State Street were the two non-lending funds. One thing on Northern Trust is it's a little bit of a smaller fund than what the others are out there, but we don't anticipate that that's going to cause a problem regarding liquidity. If you look at the next chart, which is the performance, generally you're going to see performance as you would expect across index funds is pretty similar. You'll notice that there is excess returns across the time periods. These are mostly driven by tax reclamation activity, and that just means that they're tax advantage products that don't pay full taxes on some of the dividends, and that's not an assumption that the actual index makes. BlackRock kind of stood out with regards to overall performance numbers on excess return, but what we saw that probably about 4 to 5 basis points of that was from the securities lending. And then they said that they expect that would be maybe 3 basis points going forward. Really the next kind of best performer out there, then we're looking at Northern Trust. The one thing we've noticed on Northern Trust, if you look at the tracking error, is a little bit high. And we found out that that's primarily to do with how they implement the fair value pricing. And fair value pricing is really just a pricing mechanism to take into account events that have occurred since the foreign market closed, but before the fund is actually priced on the New York close. If anybody has any questions on that, we can talk about that in more detail. So if you'll go to the next page, please. So in our conclusion, really, they're all good, solid global equity passive solutions. In the end, we are recommending Northern Trust. It doesn't have securities lending. It does have the lowest management fee at 4 basis points. They cap their administrative fees, and they've got a shorter trade notice period. There's an appendix that follows that has a good overview of Northern Trust, just overall the organization, the key people, philosophy, process, and kind of portfolio characteristics. And then, of course, more detail is in the fact sheet and the presentation. The other part, of course, is the funding. And we are recommending funding this passive allocation from our existing global equity active managers. We would rebalance those to basically their 70% target weights, which would be about $123 million going to the passive allocation with Northern Trust. And as Kent mentioned, we would recommend that we're allowed to have a bit more range on the passive so that we allow, accumulative contributions prior to selecting the small cap and international small cap. So that concludes the recommendation. Is there questions?
Any comments or questions for staff? Hearing none, the recommendation, we have three recommendations. One is to approve the structure for the global equity asset class to include the index funds or the passive. The second one is to recommend hiring Northern Trust to serve as the global equity investment manager. And third is to fund it from the existing global equity managers, as Greg just outlined. Does anybody feel we need to do them separately, or can we take them as a group?
Let's go as a group.
I'm all for that. Okay, so we have a motion to approve those three. So, Gilbert, I'm assuming as chair of the IAC, you're making that motion?
Yes, sir.
Do we have a second?
Armando with a second.
Armando is the second. Okay, anybody opposed to approving these three recommendations? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved. Great. Thank you. Okay, Ryan, you're up next with the cash flow, private asset cash flow update, and a real estate overview.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. John, I can go ahead to 108. With this being the first private asset cash flow review of the year, I'm going to take a look back at 2020 activity and compare that to the projections we made in January of 2020. And we also took a fresh look at some of the 40-year estimates and assumptions. So we'll review some of the changes there. At a high level, clearly with the dumpster fire that was 2020 and COVID and the shutdowns, it wasn't a strong year for cash flow coming back in the private asset portfolio, as most of the managers shifted to playing, you know, quite a bit of defense. bulk of the cash flows we saw came from the real estate portfolio, and we expect this trend to continue into 2021. Go ahead, one slide, John. And just as a reminder, we got detailed schedules and attachments in closed session that kind of fill out all the assumptions that go into all of the high-level charts we're going to review. So if you guys have any questions on anything that's feeding into to any of this info, just stop me down and let me know. Just wanted to make kind of a few clarifying statements that we have much more control and visibility into directly owned real estate and natural resources than we do, you know, across the private equity portfolio. So, you know, we talked about the four projections. Like I said, we got a lot more confidence and visibility when we're talking about that as part of the portfolio as opposed to the private equity. So looking back a little bit historical on 110, so going back to 9/30/16, we started with had about $1.6 billion in private market assets at that point. In the last 4 years, we cut the portfolio in about half, a little bit more than half, with over $1 billion in distributions, $240 million in capital calls, which gets us to the current reported value, which we'll talk more about, of $722 million. Going ahead two slides to 112. This is just a review of the private asset cash flow in Q4 20. We had 1.2 million in capital calls outgoing, 2.2 million in incoming distributions. The bulk of that came from the ag portfolio. Just note, this is the lowest quarter of activity we've seen since we started tracking this, and probably, you know, before that. So we'll go into a little bit more detail in the following slide of 2020 year in review on 115. So we had $32 million in net inflow, so distributions less capital calls going out. Putting this into context, getting negative stuff out of the way, you know.
Hold on one second. Ryan, what slide do you want us on, Ryan?
113. Sorry about that. Thanks, John.
Go ahead.
So $32 million in net inflows, putting that in context, that compares to an average of $37 million per quarter the last 2 years. So when we talk about activity slowing down, it slowed down, you know, got cut in a quarter of what we've been rolling at prior. That being said, you know, we're really glad to get some of the sales we did in the portfolio. With everything coming to a complete halt, we had great timing on getting the Union office and retail sold in February, which led to a big chunk of the money we got back. And then even though we haven't seen sales out of them yet, we made great progress on Campbell Square and getting that queued up and ready to go for an early 2021 sale. And we have the Spring Valley property under contract with, you know, sale expected here in the next couple months. Any questions on 2020 activity compared to projected before I move forward? Okay, we're going to go up to 115, John, and talk a little bit about the private asset NAV adjustment that we're still taking. Remember, we started this process back in April where the reported NAV, which is the current value that our custodian, J.P. Morgan, has on the books based on the most recent statement reported by the GPs and managers. Given, you know, the market downturn of COVID, we started taking this adjustment, adjusting the market value up or down. based on what we have been hearing on the graph from the manager. So currently our reported NAV is $722 million. We're taking a 15% adjustment down to $612 million. So about $110 million adjustment. The bulk of that adjustment is coming in the private equity portfolio and in real estate, whereas in private debt infrastructure, we've had updated marks come in based on 2020 reporting, and we've been able to remove the adjustment. We did a look back, kind of comparing it to where we sit at now with this adjustment to where we started in April. And at a high level, our current adjusted value of 611 is pretty close to where we had adjusted value out to back then. So that's helped out a lot with rebalancing decisions throughout the year, looking at the adjusted NAV. And then since April, we've actually booked write-downs of 13% based on updated reporting from the managers, and we're taking an additional adjustment down to 15%. So I'm going to move ahead to slide 117 to talk a little bit about, forward projections and more specifically what we're looking at in 2021. You can see here that the lighter dotted line is our net inflow projection from a year ago, as compared to the dash blue and dash orange line of our current projection based on the reported and adjusted NAV. So you really see there around the billion-dollar mark where everything kind of just got pushed out about a year, once we started making these changes throughout the year in 2020. For 2021, we are projecting $164 million in distributions from the private market portfolio. Since the last few years, we come in lower than the projected amount. We really wanted to take a deeper look at confidence levels and what is actually going to close, what's in the bag, what's a little bit more speculative. So there should be a big chunk of sales closing that I talked about earlier in the real estate portfolio in the next few months, and we should probably get more money back in Q1 than we got in all of 2020. So about half of that 164 we put in the bag. It's under contract. It's, unless something unforeseen happens, it's going to close. About another quarter of that money is planned. The wheels are in motion. The sales should occur, but they're not quite under contract yet. And about a quarter of that amount we would call, it could occur, it's possible. There's more risk to closing and they're a little bit more speculative, or maybe they're, in the private equity portfolio where we're taking this fund's near the end of life and we've got to start getting money at some point. So it's a third distribution schedule and that's feeding into that amount. But I would say as compared to prior years doing this, we have a higher amount of money in the, immediate closing or pretty high confidence interval level of what we expect to come back. As I said earlier, similar to the past few years, the bulk of the 164 we're talking about, 85% would be coming from the real estate portfolio. We have a little bit more visibility and control. Talking with our real estate managers, we're hopeful things can return to somewhat normal level by mid 2021. Some of the retail hospitality assets were expecting it to creep into 2022 before we can return to normal. So, like I said, we'll wait and see a little bit, but we are positive on having some sales that are right around the corner. So with that, I'm not going to cover the last two charts, but any questions on what I covered or any assumptions leading into it?
Okay. Anybody, one last chance before we move on. Okay, is there anything we're going to cover in open session on the real estate overview, or are we going to closed session?
No, we'll go straight to close for all of it, Bill.
Okay, before we do that, Kelly, why don't you do your executive director's report so that we can then go to closed session and only come back for the different approvals that we may need.
Okay, that sounds good, Bill. The executive director's report starts on page 125. There you'll find the NCPR monitor reports.
In addition to that, on as far as an update on open records requests, we've received one since the last board meeting. That one is actually from a member, and we will be responding to that in two parts. One, we do have the information available, so we will, once that's reviewed, provide that information. And then the other part of the request, the information isn't available yet, but as soon as it is, we will provide it to them. COVID response, we are still status quo. We haven't really made any changes since we talked last month. We're still fine-tuning our document distribution and receipt process since we're doing that differently. It seems to be being well accepted by the members, but we're working out a few kinks with that. But otherwise, things seem to be going well. And then we discussed under the staff retirement plan the status of the compensation review. So I think you're well aware of where we are with that, and hopefully we'll have that information for you in 2 weeks. That's all I have for you today.
Thanks, Kelly. Any questions for Kelly before we move on? Okay, if that's the case, we're going to go to closed sessions under 55.1.071, 0.072, and 0.074 for investment, legal, and personnel discussions. According to our agenda, this will probably be in closed session for about 45 minutes before we come back to open session. So for those folks who want to hang on there, they're welcome to do so. Those who want to sign off, that's fine. So thanks very much, and let's go to closed session now, John.